umbrella lady. Umbrellas, men to hand lady. Umbrellas to men.
So here's what we're going to do. We're going to do a couple of things. First, we're going to establish the bookshop, and then we're going to do either, it could be a very short, or it may spill over into the next session, but we have to get Nora back somehow, aren't we?
Yes, I'm.
She's currently,
trapped in in a movie.
You're trapped in the Maltese Falcon.
Yep.
Basically. TJ, how could you have not known that we did the Maltese Falcon? So Nora is basically now in the Maltese Falcon, which is taking huge liberties, but with everything. But I've got a little something planned, and I think it could be kind of fun. And there's an opportunity for someone to get a bit more sanity back as a result, a little mini game. But we're going to do another mini game first. Let's do the mechanical bit first. Well, it's sort of narrative and sort of mechanical. I came up, you will find this extraordinary, those of you that know me as a gamer, I came up with a mini game for creating the bookshop, or rather not as a gamer, as someone that has any feeling for rules or anything like that. I should have asked Spencer or Barney to come up with these rules, but I came up with them myself. So, well, you write games, don't you? You write game rules.
I think that's rather grand.
You have written game rules. The first thing we're going to do is we're going to establish the credit rating of your bookshop. We're going to do this first, and then we'll do the name and the ambience and the atmosphere and all of that, because the credit rating should really drive a lot of that if you're at this sleazy, scuzzy bookshop versus maybe you're a little bit more upmarket and whatever. I suppose it should definitely inform it. So, first things first, all of you at this point are back in London in some way or other.
Does that mean Nora is in a copy of the Maltese Falcon that we've brought back?
Don't get ahead of yourself, Barney. Don't get ahead of yourself. It's coming.
I'm not. You've just said we're all in London in one way or another.
I'll get there. Okay, let's say all of the corporeal characters are in London right now.
In one way or another. Okay.
Right. All of the corporeal characters are in London. So I guess what we discussed is that really this is Dr. Emery's bookshop, right? Well, sort of, and Hamps as well.
I think Emery should have always had this bookshop.
Really?
Maybe it's like a family business that he's inherited.
Mm. Ah, that's nice. Oh, that's great. Yes, that's really, really good. But perhaps it was shuttered and the property was there. Maybe a bit of stock, but you needed Hamp's money to make it a going concern again.
Does that suit you, TJ?
Yeah, anything's fine.
No, because we discussed it, that you would be the sort of sleeping...
I sent you some stuff. I don't know if you've shared any of that with anybody, though.
I haven't got a fucking clue.
I sent that directly to you as a possibility.
No, I love it. Okay, let's start with this then. Let's start with this. Ham, why don't you narrate a little bit about how you got this bookshop kind of back on its feet?
I sent you like a long thing.
Well, summarize it then. I don't know. Or read it. No, I liked it. It was good.
Andy, we talk a lot. No, actually, I just jabber away and you don't really even respond. This is really kind of embarrassing going back through this chat log.
That's why he wants you to read it, because he hasn't looked at it.
Skipped over it.
No, I read it and I liked it. I read it and I liked it.
No, I'm just kidding. I'm kidding. So yeah, the idea is Hamp proved his worth to the group when they got back to England by donating some occult texts that he had collected over the years as sort of incidental things to some stuff he had pulled back as a job out of when he was smuggling stuff out of South America. And there's a lot of stuff here, Andy. That was really going on. But the basic idea, without getting into all the ins and outs of this artifact I apparently just created out of whole cloth, is that because Hamp has a good credit rating, he wants to set up shop in London. So he wants to set up like a logistics business and kind of go legit. And so he offers to rent from the old fart who are trying to rent the whole like three stories of this building that has the bookstore in it, or from the picture, two stories and a basement, right? He wants to rent that from them, the basement, as his office for his logistics business. But what he doesn't understand is with his, you know, kind of lack of knowledge of conversion rates of whatever else, he's basically, the rent that they're charging him is the rent for the entire building, plus enough for about 31 roast beef sandwiches and a case of gin a month.
I think it's even worse than that, because if we do go with the idea that this is actually a property that's been in Emery's family, I mean, Emery is effectively the landlord, so that's who...
Yeah, and here's the other thing to it that, how did I phrase it? They would basically say, look, okay, because they feel like they pay Hamp generously with free rent every month. So he's actually their landlord from their point of view. So anytime someone shows up as like a bill collector or an on the take constable or whatever else, whatever gang person in the neighborhood is giving them problems, they refer to him as the landlord and he has to deal with the people. But because of the various colorful accents of Greater London, he's never quite understands what is happening. And so he just attributes it to his oaky bad luck. And he comes down and basically apologizes to everyone that like these people keep showing up.
It's brilliant.
But I don't know that it's getting away from comedy.
No. Remember, we don't. White Dwarf is fine. White Dwarf is fine. But we want comedy in this one.
The gloves are off.
The comedy gloves are off. Bare knuckle comedy all the way. So Hamp, that's the backstory. It's brilliant. I love it.
I went through and copied it and pasted it into the White Dwarf session if anyone wants to look at it.
It is nice.
It just goes on and on.
I don't think Rita should know about this because I don't think she could honestly live with herself if she knew about this scam. She would just tell Hamp that that's what they're doing.
Yeah, I don't think she would. I think it would only be probably Emery and Milton that would know.
Yeah.
Maybe just Emery.
It does rather make Emery and Milton a couple of fucking arseholes.
I've had my suspicions for a long time, but I didn't want to say, you know?
I mean, essentially, they're just taking advantage of a poor...
But it's all things I think that Hamp just offered, and they're just kind of like, well, okay.
I'm not sure I understand the full implications of it, to be honest.
Essentially, you're just charging him an extortionate amount of rent because he doesn't understand the exchange rate, and it pays for the entire building and the next door pie shop.
I don't think Milton would understand that he was ripping anyone off.
Okay, fair enough.
Yeah, that's the thing. I think it's too convoluted for any of us to really understand the full implications.
Yeah, I'm quite happy for Emery to have got an accountant from somewhere who's sort of set all this up. And Emery's oblivious to it as well. The accountant is set it up in such a way that Emery thinks Hamp is the landlord. Hamp thinks Emery is the landlord.
That's brilliant.
So would this work if Emery's family own it, but Hamp has now bought a lease out on the property?
Yes, yeah.
Absolutely. And most of the money goes to the butchers to buy the fillings for Milton's pies. I think that'd be great. And cat food.
Yes, I do suggest that the shop should have a cat, so that way if Anarchy starts purring then.
Absolutely.
Yes, it's just ambient sound effects.
So Rita, you're on the upstairs. Your detective agency is called what?
We are called Foxtrot Research.
And you're, what is it? Consulting detective. Well, detectives maybe at some point in the future, but detective right now.
We investigate.
It's not we. It's not we for the moment.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, no, that's right. In Nora's honour, I say we in the sense of the royal we. In honour of Nora, I've set up Foxtrot Research. And I talk to her all the time. And I'm learning the organ. So I practice the organ. Nora's always there. When jobs come in, I check with Nora if it seems like a good job. We don't want anything too dangerous, and at the same time, don't want anything too boring. So it's always something mildly... It's got some little twist to it.
Have you ever had a paid commission yet? A paid job?
No.
Curious. No, I don't think so.
The right people haven't come in.
Yeah, but any day now...
They keep coming in. They think, you know, oh, someone stole their car. They want us to go and check the car. Oh, the wife is doing this, that the husband's doing that. Oh, some other family member's embezzling money and ripping someone else off, or, you know, property or something. No. So I say, I'll call you again tomorrow. And then I get back to the organ.
Fantastic. You've done some free work, though. Pro bono, perhaps.
Well, I do a couple of shifts in the bookshop when Emery's too drunk. Is that what you mean?
Yeah, whatever. No, I was wondering whether you've done it. No, because it could be an interesting plot seeds there if we want, but...
We keep our eye on things. We might be gearing up with a couple of jobs, you know, personal. I think I should probably be switching into the Irish accent, really, because I'd come in a bit late to that, really, but, you know, better late than never. Yeah, you know, there's lots of strange goings on in London, really.
So, Milton, then, your pie shop. Tell me about your pie shop.
But this pie shop is... I do a speciality eel pie that seems to go down well.
And comes up even better.
Indeed. And I've had this... when trying to think of a name, I kept hearing this... It sort of came to me in a dream, almost. Tulush? T-U-L-U-S-H... Tulush pies. Is that how I would say it?
Tulush.
Tulush pies? Is that... Should we know that from somewhere?
It's... I may be pronouncing it incorrectly, but it's a mythos reference. Tulush? Or Tulush? T-U-L... No, T-U-L-U-S-H.
Yeah, it doesn't ring a bell with me either.
Pie god, isn't it, Spencer? It's the pie god.
Well, no, it's eels, eel-like beings.
Oh, all right. Oh, God.
You see?
Oh, that's a bit...
And this, I was almost haunted by this word, so I'm...
Oh, the humanoid eels. Yes, I do. I have heard of them.
Yes.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. I think it's probably not... It's definitely not Lovecraft, though, is it? It's something else.
Is it not? Well, that's my...
No, but it doesn't... No, that's fine.
Knowledge falls down. Expanded Cthulhu mythos. Yeah, so.
Yeah, they're from the actual role-playing game. It's something invented for the
role-playing game. Ah, right. Sinkhole by Michael Le Bozier.
Yeah. Okay, Tulush. Lovely. Has any of you ever eaten an eel pie in a pie and mash shop? They're fucking horrible.
No, I haven't. No,
I've never been within 1,000 miles of a pie and mash shop.
No.
I've never eaten in one.
I don't get it.
We did have a pie and mash shop in New Bradwell for a while. This guy came up from the East End of London and decided that his dream was to open up a pie and mash shop in Milton Keynes. And he set one up on the high street, pretty much bordered by a really good Indian takeaway and a fairly good Chinese takeaway, with a good kebab shop a few doors down. But set up this real hole in the wall pie and mash shop, and he made all his own stuff, made liquor from scratch and made a variety of pies. And I really wanted to support him because, yeah, it was a new business that came along, and I went there once and it was the worst fucking takeaway I've ever had in my life. I swear the pastry on the pie was made of recycled cardboard. The meat in the pie was absolutely flavourless, and the liquor, I don't know about a flavour, but had a texture and a colour that I can only describe as rancid dog semen.
Oh my word. I was dreading what you were going to say there, and it was even worse than what I was dreading.
Thing is, Scott, I've been to one of the best pie and mash shops in London, and it wasn't much better than what you described. So I think it's inherent in the eel and pie and mash genre that it's going to be somewhat dog semen-y, in that direction at least.
How do you guys know?
If you've ever had a dog...
I think I might be putting my pie shop up for sale.
TJ, some advice for life here. Never ask questions you don't want the answer to.
One of the most amazing things I've ever seen...
We've achieved horror.
...was a dog shit. I saw a dog shit once, and the beginning and the end of the dog shit was shit. But then the middle of the shit was some of that blue nylon rope. That was it. There was shit at either end, and then there was just blue... rope. That was the prevailing part of the shit. That was just...
He did a rope shit. The dog did a rope shit.
Like, I don't know, it was just...
That is what is known in technically as a rope shit.
Yeah, is it? Yeah.
Is there a name? No, dear.
If you get a really talented dog, it can tie the rope in knots on the way through.
Well, Nora, I hope we'll get to you in a minute, but...
Oh, no. I'm having fun listening to you guys, so we're good.
Okay. All right, well... Having set all of that up, we are now going to get into the mechanics. So, Hamp, given that you are providing the funds, we need you, and you can't spend luck on any of these rolls, you need to make a credit rating roll. And this, the level of success or failure, will determine the credit rating of the shop, which has a big impact on what you can do with it on the bookshop. We're not going to do this for any of the other businesses.
But do you want me to roll that at home, TJ? Shall I roll it for you at home? Real dice.
So, TJ... Oh, my word, that was a good roll. You almost got an extreme. Well, a hard success, it means that the credit rating of the shop is going to go up by one from the base where it was. So rather than being a level 2 bookshop, I'm a level 2 bookshop. I went down a dungeon, fought a librarian, and now I'm a level 3 bookshop. It's gone up to a level 3 bookshop. So what that means is the bookshop's credit rating... Can you roll 3d6, please, Hamp? Goodness me.
I hope I was going for high on that one.
Yeah. All right. So the bookshop's credit rating is 59, which is very, very good.
That is 40 higher than Emery's credit rating.
Yes.
That's how we're procuring the good stuff.
So that will have a big impact on your ability to use the bookshop to interact with NPCs and to acquire rare books and all kinds of things like that. So that's pretty damn good. Now, can you narratively maybe just tell me, I guess we've already been through all the accounting. I don't know, maybe we don't need to. But what is it that's giving you this extra boost? There has to be something that suddenly made the money.
I think at some point he sold off a lot of his American business holdings.
Right.
When he got over here, he had old broken down planes and maybe some warehousing and stuff like that he was using for logistics in America. And once he got over here, he kind of took a taste for living in England. And he's lived in England before, so during World War I. So maybe he's getting a little nostalgic. And so he sells off some stuff and has this kind of influx of money. And he put that into the business because he really liked the idea of a bookshop. He thinks that's really high society and interesting, even though he doesn't quite get it himself.
He sold off his silver mine, his Brazilian silver mine, something along those lines. Right. Okay. Wonderful. I know. That would be a lot of money.
How many years after the last events is this taking place?
So this is going to take place in 1932. So this is maybe a year or two after. I can't remember actually what we said. Maybe 1933, 32 or 33. Right, now, so that's the credit rating established. Now, what the rest of you is going to get to do, including Nora, even though she's only fictional at this point, as opposed to the rest of you that are real, each of you can, and you can do this either by making a roll or you could sort of narrate it and I'll give you a bonus dice. It's up to you. You don't have to narrate if you don't want to, but you need to choose one of your skills. Theoretically, it could be any skill, but it kind of makes more sense if it's a knowledge-based skill, but it doesn't have to be. And what you need to do is you need to roll that skill. And if you, depending on what you roll, the bookshop gains a skill level of that skill. So from that point on, anyone can use the bookshop's skill in that. If we can, it means, what it means is there would be books available around that subject if you make the skill roll. So let's start with Emery, given that it's his bookshop. I would recommend that you take one of your highest skills because that sets the base.
I think it's going to have to be anthropology because that is Emery's main interest. So yeah, that makes sense.
So if you can narrate some scene or moment or even a book title around anthropology, I will give you the bonus dice when you make the roll. So how did you establish your anthropology collection?
I think, given Emery's pretty terrible credit rating and some of the weirder things that he's been through recently, I think that he has got in contact with a security guard at a university library at some stage and basically slipped him £10 to look the other way while Emery goes in and helps himself to a few key texts from the rare book collection.
Fantastic. Just straight away stealing the book. That's amazing. That's great.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, obviously, Emery would much rather do this the proper way and build up stock by buying and selling, but you have to do what you must in order to get the business started.
You do. You absolutely do. I think the time for running a legitimate business is going to be later on, you know, once you get round to it.
I thought Andy was going to say that the time for running a legitimate business has passed, but not as in the future. So.
Oh, I see. Yeah, all right. Yeah, maybe. Okay.
But I'm sure if you go back far enough in the history of any business, you'll find that they're rooted in all sorts of misdeeds. And the book trade is no different.
Oh, no, that's absolutely spot on. The book trade in London at this time is a refuge for scoundrels and villains. Absolutely. And you're just doing a minor indiscretion compared to what some people will do to get their hands on books.
Indeed.
Right. So you can roll anthropology with a bonus dice. Hit the purple and let us see. Oh, my word.
Yes, that's an extreme.
That's an extreme. Jesus Christ. All right, this is going to be crazy because you're already there. Wow. Roll a d10.
2.
So your bookshop's anthropology rating is 92.
Okay.
You have access, I suppose, to like a literally the world class, like the rarest, most important anthropology books in the world from your little clandestine activities. Right.
One thing I don't quite understand is, are these books for sale or is this our knowledge base or both or what?
It's fluid. You can sell them, you can use them. in the rules, in the actual Trail of Cthulhu rules, they're like a resource. You get a certain number of points and you have to spend them. But I don't think you ever lose the books, but you lose the points and then they have to be refreshed somehow. But I'm not going to play it that way. I'm just going to say you've got this knowledge like bank. Like, it's like having a mythos tome that improves, that you can use it to roll Cthulhu mythos roll, but this is just...
I suppose the great thing is that the amount of money that Hamp is paying means that no books need to be sold, so they could be totally excessively priced, yeah?
If you ever go in a used bookshop, isn't that what you see? Like, people are buying, like, tattered copies of Terry Pratchett, but there's, like, that $200, like, old book up on the shelf that, like, is some sort of actual collector's item that everyone's like, oh, that's neat, and then they keep walking.
The only thing I would say is a lot of the scenario seeds are about buying and selling books, so you would want to be in the trade, otherwise you're not getting new stock in and new...
You know, another, just to throw in, I don't think Terry Pratchett was writing in 1933.
I'm well aware. I mean, when we walk into bookstores, we were also were not alive in 1933.
I didn't mean to suggest that you weren't. Well, it was more for the listeners.
We're going to prove our bona fides. We're not complete.
We're just, there's a disclaimer, like, he's an American idiot, but he's not that big of an American idiot.
It was an illustrative example.
Right. Milton. On to Milton.
Well, it's going to have to be archaeology, isn't it?
I'd love it if someone does Fighting Brawl.
Well, actually, I could do, actually. I'm not bad at Fighting Brawl. Should I give that a go? We could have a pugilist section.
In a weird sort of way, what it means is that you would be better at fighting inside the shop for some reason, which I love the idea of that.
Yeah, you've just got a bunch of really heavy bookends to hand that you can club people with.
Yeah, because essentially, if you don't go for a knowledge-based skill, you still get that level, but it's just interesting. Yeah,
exactly.
I mean, you can, but no, you want to go for archaeology.
Well, language is pretty good. I could go for language.
Yeah, well, it's not a very useful skill. That's the problem.
Well, let's go archaeology then. Here we go. It is boring.
Oh, wait, so do you want to narrate? I mean, you've already made the role and it didn't improve, but just for flavour.
I'm not sure, really. I don't know. I'm wondering whether...
Spencer, I think you must have turned your back on your profession to go into the pie business. You can't still count yourself as an archaeologist, can you, or whatever, if you're making pies every day.
But when he's out digging up eels from the muddy banks of the Thames...
Of the Thames, yeah, exactly. Maybe I've come across some old scriptures or something...
I love the idea of Milton in the waders, like standing in the mud on Cheapside.
I've still got those waders.
With a basket full of wriggling eels and as well as a few Roman curse tablets.
Fantastic, fantastic.
Well, yeah, and it was acquiring those waders in San Francisco that prompted me, encouraged me to become an eel forager.
An eel salesman. Right, well, you can roll 3d6 as well.
Oh, right, that was good enough, was it?
Yeah, love it. Oh, okay, 9. So, archaeology. So, the bookshop's archaeology rating is 69, which is, I think, probably better than anyone else. I don't think anyone else has got archaeology. I suppose that's the other thing, is you kind of almost need to metagame it a bit, because you want to do one that no one else has got. Otherwise, it's a bit pointless, because then someone else might have a better skill than the bookshop. But anyway.
That's good, right? It's good.
All right, so, Nora... This will be some point in the future, so you don't have to narrate it, but I'll give you the bonus dice anyway, and you can narrate it when you emerge. So what do you... Social roles also very valid, by the way, as well as knowledge, because it almost has a personality, the bookshop. So say you wanted to use charm, you could give it a charm score, or if you wanted to use psychology or something like that, or whatever, you know.
I think I'll do charm. Charm's my thing.
Okay.
So bonus dice?
Yeah.
And then I'll think of a way to... narrate that when I'm out of my celluloid dream.
All right. Okay, well, that's just a regular success, but that's okay. So, charm. So, yeah, in your case, roll 3d6 as well.
3d6.
Ooh, look at that. So the bookshop has a charm of 72.
Nice.
Anthropology, archaeology, charm. It's a charming place. Perhaps it's changed my perception of it.
It has a nicer personality than anyone who works there.
Yes, which is often the case with bookshops, I find.
It's the cat.
It is the cat, yes. Right.
Could there be, you know, a soiree every Friday afternoon, you know, drink soiree? you know, which makes it all the more charming, you know, and you can
Wine and eels evening.
Yeah, wine and eels evening, exactly.
What do you mean it's every Friday evening? I think with Emery in charge, it's every other night, isn't it? Every morning.
But that's demanding if you're opening that up to the public every day. You know, the idea that, you know, once a week people come by, drink more than they buy.
Yeah, of course. Readings by local lunatics.
We have a selection of the finest breakfast gins.
I think you've invented something brilliant there. Right, Rita.
Could we have a bookshelf, which is kind of a fake bookshelf, and you open it, and it's this amazing drinks cabinet with all of the breakfast gins in?
Oh, yes.
It's got these fake book spines on it, and you open it up, and it's all the booze inside.
You know, people are in America, they're saying, you know, you got to go to their bookshop. I tell you, when you go to London, you got to go there. They got this fake bookshelf. It's fantastic.
Right.
Oh, I hate that accent. I hate that person that you just created.
I hate that person too. So, Rita, what skill are you going to try and impart upon this bookshop?
Let me tell you, I was upstairs, tidying the place up, getting it ready, you know, the whole foxtrot thing, you know, and talking to Nora about this. And then there's this massive noise outside. It's just this crashing of metal on metal. It's disastrous. I said, Nora, that sounds like a car accident. So an automobile, I suppose you call them then. And I rush downstairs and I want to help. So there are these automobiles on the road and they're not in a good state. So I get underneath them. I mend them up a little bit. So use the old brains. I tell you now, people know. Maybe they don't know that if they're being haunted by their great aunt and so-and-so or whatever, they know that they can come upstairs to me and they can get their car mended.
You're going to give it a drive skill?
No, it's mechanical repair.
All right, so roll with a bonus dice, your mechanical repair.
I just rolled 19 against 55.
So that's a hard success. Very good. All right, so roll 3d6.
1, 2, 4, 7.
7. All right, so it has a mechanical repair of 67. I don't know how or what that implies.
The building's better at mending cars than I am.
That's exactly what I was thinking.
I said we've got a whole wall of Haynes manuals.
I've been in that used bookshop in Texas.
Yeah, so, brilliant. Now, we need a little bit of colour. So, going round again from the top from Hamp, can you describe one aspect of the shop? Everyone gets to describe one aspect of the shop.
Hamp has provided a lot of maps over the years, or the year, as decor. So there's a good deal of unused navigational charts and things like that that he didn't need that are thrown up as any place that there's some blank wall and not a bookshelf. There's going to be some sort of map probably pasted over another map and then over another map because he had way too many for the small amounts of blank space and he couldn't make his mind up on which ones they should hang.
This bookshop is getting weirder by the minute, but I like it. All right.
The great thing is you can roll them up and keep them stored in a container. And when the right moment, the right customer appears, you can get the map out and show them that map.
That's amazing. Right, Emery. Are we getting the cat?
I think we are getting the cat, yes. I mean, the cat didn't quite come with the bookshop, but one day it just sort of appeared. Someone maybe left the door open for too long, and this rather fat tortoiseshell tabby wandered in and has been there ever since. It just likes sleeping in improbable places. It finds all the smallest little nooks above the bookshelves and somehow gets up there. No one ever sees it climb up, but it's just up there. And, yeah, again, no one claims ownership of it, but every now and then I suppose we all take turns in feeding it, and it sits there and glowers at the customers, much in the same way as Emery does.
I think it also would give everyone a bit of a bonus on if there are any fights in the bookshop for any reason, the cat's presence would give people a little bit of an advantage, as it takes a vicious swipe at someone.
Absolutely. And, yeah, Emery has named it Melpomene.
Melpomene?
Melpomene.
Not heard of that. Is that the Greek?
Yes, the muse of tragedy.
Sounds about right. I'm going to put bonus to fighting brawl in certain circumstances. Nora, Nikki, describe one aspect of this bookshop. Smell, sound, sight, objects, people maybe, anything really.
Boy, what would Nora want to have in the bookshop? Okay, she's going to describe a strange repeat customer who's always coming in to the bookshop. He comes in mainly to pet the cat, but he also seems to always like to hang out in the occult section. And he is very tall and gaunt and pale-faced. And he wears a, what did they have, fedoras back then? And yep, and he's always in there, and he always pets the cat, and then he always goes over and he gets one, the same book out, and he just pores over it. He never buys it, even with Dr. Emery standing there asking him if he wants to buy it.
Pointedly.
Yes. But yes, he pets the cat, he reads the book, and then he leaves, and he does it almost every day the bookshop is open.
Brilliant. I love that. That's amazing. That actually is an M.R. James story you've just described. The tractate mid-off. But also, you've also described Mr. Sleep from The Disintegrator, which is even more awesome. I think this has to be Mr. Sleep, doesn't it? But anyway, so yeah, Milton.
I was just thinking, does everyone live above the shop?
They all bunk. Well, imagine Emery lives above the shop. I don't know whether Rita does.
Right. I was just wondering if it's a two-story bookshop or whoever. It's just on the ground floor.
The shop's just the ground floor, I think.
Right. Okay. That's fine. Well, I'd like to think there's a nice kind of reading area of a couple of really big leather armchairs that are mainly there for us, to be honest. It's suggested they're for the customers, but I think we probably use them more than anyone else.
It's more like your social club, isn't it, this place, rather than a business.
Yeah.
That sounds like most bookshops.
Yeah, that's why they don't exist anymore. Great, love it. And then Rita.
So I think the Foxtrot rooms are above the pie shop. I think that the building must be this double kind of thing, and then I guess there's more books above the shop. And you access it through the bookshop, even though it's above the pie shop. So I can smell the pies, but I can't walk down and get one. And I'm thinking that the space that I got for the Foxtrot Research Agency, I put a curtain up, you know, maybe two-thirds into the room. So the one-third behind the curtain is this, basically, I mean, I'm trying to contact Nora. So I got all the stuff that I figure out I can use. And, you know, so I got the pentagram on the floor and all of the other kind of stuff, Ouija boards, all the kinds of things. And I'm always trying to find a way to get in contact with her.
Yeah, nice segue, perfect segue. But before we do that, we need a name.
I mean, the boring reality is most bookshops in London, I'd say, almost all of them just use the proprietor's name.
We could do that, Watson's Rare Books.
Sounds
yeah, right.
Watson's Antiquities.
Watson's Antiquities.
Yeah, Watson's Antiquities, I think.
Oh, I like that, yeah.
Watson's Antiquities.
Hamp's logistics company is titled Ponca Atypical Transportation, Shipping, and Procurement.
Ponca Atypical Pat.
No, it doesn't stand for anything.
Okay.
I didn't go the comedy route. That's just what he would call it. Ponca City was his hometown, so.
I know. Yeah, I remember. It is a real place. All right. So we have the bookshop. Now, let me describe what the credit rating implies. I put it into the chat, but I'll read it out anyway. Now, I think we have to change this a little bit. But anyway, at this level, the smell of tea or wine, almost definitely wine and probably gin.
Yeah, I think gin and sherry, yes.
Gin and sherry is stronger than the smell of dust and damp. Actual shelves line the walls. Amazing. You've got shelves. You've arrived, kids. You've arrived. You've got shelves. Actual shelves line the walls and march down the middle of the sagging linoleum floor. Oh dear, that's a bit downmarket, isn't it? Linoleum. The shop's politics may be modishly left, but the stock is staunchly Victorian or even Regency. Its bohemian clientele browses for books in Bloomsbury, Soho, Clerkenwell, or Covent Garden. The catalogue may aim at a specialist or avant-garde trade. There isn't quite enough quality stock to justify a general catalogue, which doesn't mean there isn't one. May own a dangerously shabby van or truck. I think that last line is just the kicker. You have a shabby van with a really badly painted logo on the side. Brilliant. Now, I'm not going to take the geographical cue because I definitely wanted to put you in a specific place. So if you look at the Roll 20, oh, that's really zoomed in for me. I don't know about you guys. This is where you are. You're basically in a part of London called Dalston. You're on a very busy thoroughfare called the Kingsland Road. Actually, you're sort of on the boundary between Stoke Newington High Street and the Kingsland Road. Very close to the corner of my favourite street name in London, Bulls Pond Road. The Bulls Pond Road.
A friend of mine used to live there.
Yeah, my dad was born literally where your bookshop is. So it's right opposite a street called Alvington Crescent, where my dad grew up in the 1920s. You're really close to the famous Ridley Road Market, a scene of much political unrest in years to come. And what characterises this particular part of London is the massive Jewish community lived here, about 100,000 Jewish inhabitants of this area, which is pretty much the entire Jewish population of the United Kingdom at this point. Maybe not the entire, maybe it's at least 50% of the Jewish population lived here.
I'd always associated Golders Green more with the Jewish population in London. Did that come later?
Came later, because Golders Green was more expensive. So Stoke Newington, Stamford Hill and the East End was where the Jewish immigrants first arrived, and then they migrated further westward as they became a bit more wealthy over time. But yeah, this was the epicentre of the Jewish community, really. And that's why Ridley Road Market had such a kind of rough history, because there was a lot of fascist activity around there because of the large Jewish community. But of course, it's literally, you're on the exact border of the East End. So just a few hundred yards south of you, technically the East End starts. Although anyone born here would be born within the sound of Bow Bells, which makes you an East Ender. And the East End of London, just briefly, and then we'll get on to the fun stuff. It extends as far as Blackwall on the Thames, which is much further to the east. But it begins at the edge of the city of London, which is quite a salubrious area. It's a large area. In fact, the Bow Bells, which, as I said, all true Cockneys must be born within the sound of, are in Cheapside in the city itself. The East End began as marshy ground outside the walls of the city proper, slowly drained by the original Black Wall of the Saxons. Since medieval times, the East End has been where London put its blood, its stenches, and its death. Tanneries, slaughterhouses, and fulling yards. The docks and canals brought steady work, along with injury and ague. The ships brought crowds of foreign sailors and workmen, and crowds of British whores and thieves. Gin houses and music halls sprang up, as did radical politics and dissenting cults. Homes were small and streets were narrow, even in Elizabethan times, with factories, gasworks, and workhouses rising in the Victorian era. Things got even worse. The East End became the Abyss. Its 1 million residents, including 100,000 Jews and 200,000 other immigrants, dwell in crowded, impoverished slums, little different from the ones that the Ripper stalked 50 years previously. Shoreditch, a centre of prostitution since the 17th century, Bethnal Green, famous for boxing and blood sports since the 18th century, Stepney, location of the Siege of Sydney Street in 1911, and the Battle of Cable Street in 1936, Limehouse, where opium and cocaine enter London, Poplar, the poorest borough in England, Wapping, site of Execution Dock, where pirates were hung in chains, and the Ripper's own Whitechapel. London's docks dominate the Isle of Dogs, once a marshy refuge for outlaws and feral hounds. Now the linchpin for 40% of Britain's trade. So, that's the East End of London, and that's where you are. Now, I should probably have moved you somewhere a bit more upmarket, but I think this is about right, given everything. Given that it was a family, that it had been the family for a long time, I think it makes sense that it's there.
Yeah, part of the charm is we can't move it, right? Like, that defeats the purpose, so...
But you're trying to sort of bring up the neighbourhood a bit by bringing investment in, so I like that.
Oh God, we're gentrifying.
Gentrification, yeah.
Now, at some point, I may bring Rabbi Cohen in. I would love to think that he did survive, but this is where he would be, because this is where the vast majority of Jewish population of Britain lived, in this neighbourhood. So a couple of years have passed since you returned from your probably quite traumatising experiences in San Francisco. And it's a Thursday morning in October 1933. Don't know the date. It's been a slow morning, Emery.
Oh, aren't they all? A true scholar doesn't rise before noon.
Exactly, exactly. You often get woken to the sound of someone banging on the door wanting either payment or something else, or maybe even to come in and buy a book, but that's more rare. And there's a banging on the... Maybe that's it. You're woken by a banging on the door.
Well, I mean, if it's the morning, Emery staggers downstairs, putting his dressing gown on, his feet into slippers, and staggers over towards the door, a scowl on his face. Yes, coming. And undoes the half-dozen locks.
And a familiar voice says, "What kind of a welcome is that for an old friend, Dr. Emery?" And you see the familiar face of Dashiell Hammett standing there on your threshold. His hair is wild and his moustache is unkempt and bristling, and he's holding a battered leather suitcase, and he says, "Doc, I've been having a hell of a time, but I'm mighty glad to see you."
"Well, I suppose you'd better come in then. I mean, while you're here, you can probably sign a few books if we have any of yours, and, coffee, tea, something more civilized."
"Got any whiskey?"
"Of course I have whiskey."
"Look, I ain't slept since Sunday. Come on, give me that whiskey and I'll tell you what's going on. It's all a bit crazy."
"Okay, I'll go over to the cabinet, reach for a bottle of the good stuff, change my mind, grab a bottle of the cheap stuff and pull it in two glasses out."
And he sits down. He's sitting on an armchair, maybe. And he lifts up his battered leather suitcase, undoes the latches, opens it up, and he pulls out this thick, untidy sheaf of paper. And he says, "Do you know what this is, Doc?" "Well, I'm sure you don't know what this is, but do you know what it is, Doc?"
"A pointless riddle for this time of the morning?"
"Yeah, yeah. Look, I'm sorry. I told you, I ain't slept. I ain't slept. Since I saw this, I ain't been able to sleep. I just had to get on a plane and get here to see you. This is my original manuscript for the Maltese Falcon."
"Yes.
But the words have changed, Doc."
"When do you say the words have changed? Do you mean that they're not quite the words you remember writing the night before? Because that does happen to me sometimes."
"Doc, I wrote this 8 years ago," he says, guessing. 1925. "Doc, I wrote prof. I should call you prof, shouldn't I?"
"I'll settle for either. Technically, I'm not a professor anymore, so Doc will do fine."
"Okay, Emery, friend. I wrote this 8 years ago. It's been made into a motion picture. It's been printed in 8 different languages. Of course, the words ain't changed. Of course, it doesn't matter where I remember them or not. These were the words, and they're not the words anymore. And they've changed. And Doc, I think it's Nora. I think she's trying to tell me something," he says, looking at you firmly in the eyes.
I'll sigh and say, "Shall I refresh your glass?"
"Please." And he takes a long swig. He says, "I started getting these strange dreams, Doc, about a month ago. I kept dreaming about Sam. Sam Spade. The guy."
"We do have one or two copies of your book around here, but I must admit I haven't actually read it yet. You may have to fill me in on some of the details."
"Right. Well, anyway, The Maltese Falcon, it's one of my best pieces, if I say so myself."
"I have heard good things. Yes, I mean, for a piece of genre fiction, it has been surprisingly well received."
"Anyway, I started having these strange dreams that somehow Nara was in the book. Well, I was kind of seeing, it was like the motion picture. I was seeing scenes from the book. And instead of it being Sam Spade's detective agency, it was Nora Charles' detective agency. And I thought, well, you know, it's just my, you know, broken heart, really. I love that girl. I mean, not like that. She's way too young for me. But she was someone I cared about deeply. And I thought one day I just tidying up old papers and whatever. And I just saw the opening page. I was flicking through. And there, I swear to God, I thought I was going mad. Sam Spade, name had gone. It was Nora Charles. She's in the manuscript, Doc. I think she's trying to tell me. Look, you never told me exactly what went on."
"Mr. Hammett, we have a couple of possibilities here. One is that someone is playing a very tasteless practical joke upon you. Let's just eliminate that as a possibility before we go down any rabbit hole, shall we? Is there anyone you can think of whose proclivities would lead them to try to play such a prank upon you?"
"Well, you mean apart from you?"
"No, I must admit I do have my capricious moments, but no, I too was rather fond of the young lady and I would not do such a thing."
"Look, no one could have done this. Not through normal means. You told me one time, Doc, do you remember that you said you saw the letters changing in that book?"
"Yes."
"And that you went inside it?"
"Yes. When we last met, we underwent a number of strange transitions that did rather blur the lines between the written world and the real world and the world of imagination and make-believe. And I suppose these things aren't always quite as different as one might like."
He says, "Look, I don't know how any of this stuff works, Doc. You know me, I'm just a regular guy. But you and your pals, you've been doing... When Rita was drunk that time, just before you left, she said something about going into a movie. And even if it's a million and one shot, you got to give it a chance, Doc. You know this stuff."
"I do. I also know how dangerous it is. But I suppose if there is any chance that young Nora is still alive, we do at least owe it to her to investigate that. I, I just have an uneasy feeling about this.
You're telling me? You think I was happy to come to this godforsaken city full of smog and fog and pollution? I mean, I think it's going to kill me probably before I get out of here.
Yes, I does seem to like the bucolic charms of Los Angeles, does it not?
So, the question is, Emery, you're going to bring your pals along in this attempt?
Yes. Well, I suppose the first thing is just to have a quick look at the manuscript to see what he's talking about, just in case he is an absolute lunatic.
I mean, you've never seen, I guess, as you said, you've never read Maltese Falcon, but yes, her name is definitely in it. And, you know, you examine it, it looks like it was written a while back. There are stains and crumples. It doesn't look like it's been forged or touched up in any way. And, you know, why would he lie to you? This looks like something genuinely has happened to the manuscript.
I'll take the manuscript then. So, yeah, well, Mr. Hammett, do you mind if I, without completing the sentence, start wandering off? And Emery looks back and says, by the way, if the cat wanders over and starts rubbing against your leg, I suggest very strongly that you don't stroke her.
Okay. Whatever you say, Doc.
And yeah, I'll wander upstairs, first of all.
So let's cut forward to a little while later. You're all, perhaps Rita, Hamp, Milton, Emery. Maybe you're upstairs looking out over the crowded Kingsland Road as people go up and down with this manuscript in front of you. You have your copy, Emery, of Unaussprechlichen Kulten there, of course, ready to refer to.
What do you think, all of you? Obviously, this is very strange. And if there is any chance that young Nora is alive, then I suppose we do owe it to her to try to recover her from this piece of pulp fiction. But I am concerned that, well, for a start, it could be dangerous, but also we are making assumptions that, or at least Mr. Hammett is making assumptions, that this is a cry for help, not, for example, a trap. What do you all think?
You know, there's a certain amount of magic in my life growing up. You know, I seen the Native Americans doing their thing, and then I get older and I start going to South America, and I'll tell you, I seen some things down there too. But the magic on these isles is a little beyond me, and it's a little more real and majestic and strange, and I don't feel like I'm out of my depth, so I defer.
Well, I think if this is coming from the manuscript, it is very much American magic. We have simply had it imported.
Yeah, this is from across the pond.
Then the problem comes, it's magic from Los Angeles, and again, out of my depth.
No, the thing is, I've been trying to get in touch with Nora all this past time, and if Mr. Hammett, who we got no reason not to trust, comes and says there's some kind of way, then frankly, the agency needs her.
Rita does have a point.
Thanks.
I suppose the next question is, if we are all agreed to take part in some kind of rescue, Emery looks down at the manuscript, the matter does remain as to how we affect it. I think maybe Nora has left us some ideas or clues throughout the manuscript. Perhaps if we divide it up between us and go through it and just see if anything leaps out, figuratively or, if we're very unlucky, literally.
If you're trying to suss out if I actually can read, the answer is yes, I can read.
Have any of you read this novel before?
I can't say I have, Emery.
No interest.
How about you, Miss Rita? You're an aspiring detective. Have you taken inspiration from Mr. Hammett's scribblings?
Maybe it was read to you as a child, Rita.
Well, I was going to say, to be honest, you know, we did run into the guy when we were over in the States, and, you know, Nora was working for him, so I've probably read it 5 times.
What you'll need to do, Emery, is effectively you have to cast that spell again, your favourite spell, which we don't even have a name for, but it's the reverse spell of the summoning, which is in some ways connected with that. It's like a gate spell, but to go into a piece of media. So we'll have to come up with a cool name for it at some point, but you're going to have to cast it, and then the people who are all within the radius of it will all be transported into that place. I'll tell you what, let's cut to Nora.
Oh boy. Okay.
Nora, you're on vacation with Isadora. You've been running Charles and Turner. Doesn't sound like a detective agency, it sounds more like a firm of accountants. Charles and Turner, consulting detectives now for 3 years in San Francisco. And you felt like it was time for, you've been working day and night to try and get the agency off the ground, and you've achieved a degree of success, finally, and a degree of comfort and income has come your way. And after 3 hard years, you finally had some time to take a vacation. And would you believe it? You've gone to Florida and the weather's terrible. The weather is absolutely terrible. So you're in this hotel and there's a crack of lightning and thunder from outside as the rain starts to fall. And you're stuck indoors. You've made friends with the hotel proprietor, but you and Isadora are having cocktails in the bar. And Isadora says, "Well, isn't it just our luck, eh? 3 years of working our fingers to the bone, trying to get that agency off the ground, and we take our first vacation in 3 years, and look at the weather. I'm going to complain. Who can I complain to, Nora?"
"Oh, I'm afraid there's probably nobody to complain to. Even the nice people who run the hotel can't control the weather."
I know. "Well, at least there's some interesting people here by the look of it." And she kind of slowly turns her head round, scans the room.
"Yes." I kind of put my head to my hand. I say, "Yes, that one in the table there looks familiar, don't you think?" And she kind of sees flashes of sometimes Hammett's face, and then more recently she's seen Dr. Emery's face. And she's like, but they're just flashes. Like, she looks at a person's face and thinks it's them, and then she looks again and it's not them.
And Isadora says, "Well, familiar in the sense that we know the type, don't we?" And she says, look at that one. He's even wearing spats. Those guys are wise guys if I've ever seen one." And looking at them, you realize they are surly. There's 3 of them sitting at a table. They look totally out of place. They're not wearing, you know, light clothing. They've got their slick suits and spats, and they're wearing their hats indoors. And maybe you can even see a little bulge in their inside pockets where the gun would be. And Isadora says, what do you think they're doing here? I mean, it's nothing to do with us, I don't think."
She'll say, "Probably not, but this might not be a vacation, Isadora." She'll walk over to them.
And as you approach, there's one with tight, curly hair. He's really broad across the shoulders and the chest, and he gets up and he says, "What you want, lady?"
And she laughs. Nora will laugh, and she'll say, "Well, my friend was just asking who we should complain to about the weather, and, well, you look like the complaints department if I've ever seen one." And she gives them a smile.
"Heh, funny you should say that. People usually don't complain after they talk to me."
"Oh."
"They don't say much at all. Now, why don't you take your pretty little butt and go back to your stool over there?"
"Well, surely you gents are here to escape the weather as well." She looks at the table. Do they have playing cards, or they're just drinking?
Yeah, they're drinking, and they've been playing poker for like the whole day. There's a big pile of cash on the table. And one of them says, "Hey, give that girl a break. What's your name, sweetheart?"
She'll smile. "Nora. Nora Charles. Pleasure."
"You want a hand?"
"Well, I think I will sit, yes." And she'll just sit down at one of the empty seats. As we've discussed, the weather is terrible, and something else to do in the hotel right now.
And then a kind of one with very heavy set features looks a bit dumb. He says, "Well, we ain't got much else to do while we're waiting for Johnny to turn up." And then the one with curly hair just kind of slaps the back of his head and says, "Shut your mouth, toots. Goddamn idiot.
You're missing a friend? I hope they're not stuck out in this weather."
"None of your business. Keep your nose out of things that don't concern you."
"Fair enough. Deal?"
And the one that's been sort of vaguely nice to you says, lay off the dame. She just wants to play a hand of cards, that's all." And then they deal. And at that point, the door to the hotel kind of bursts open. And there, silhouetted in the lightning strike from outside and the rain, is a short, overweight man in a very expensive suit and a hat. And he comes striding in and he says, "Boys, get ready. We're busting out of this joint any minute now." And he comes and he just pulls up a chair and he sits down. And he says, puts his hand out, he says, "Pleased to meet you. Johnny Rocco," and shakes you by the hand.
"Oh, pleased to meet you, Mr. Rocco."
He says, "You staying long?"
"No, this is a getaway trip for me and my partner," and I'll gesture back at Isadora. "We run a business together."
"What you selling?"
"We sell truth and justice."
"Oh, you do you? Well, ain't no such thing as justice. There's just us."
"Maybe, but it's believing in those concepts like truth that lets us believe in the big ones, like justice.
We'll see. We'll see. And at that point, you hear a siren from outside. And as one, all four of the men stand up. Not Johnny Rocco. He actually stays sitting. And you see two of them reach inside their jackets. And Johnny goes, easy, fellas, easy, fellas. Could be anything.
My, you are a jumpy bunch. Would you like me to go out and see what it is?
Johnny Rocco leans over and he just pats your hand. And he says, that's all right, sweetheart. No need to worry your pretty little head about anything. We might be staying here a little bit longer than we planned, that's all. And you might be too.
Well, I'm afraid I have to get back to my business at some point.
Yeah, well, we'll have to see about that. And we'll leave you there. And I think the last thing we will do is we will have Emery cast his spell. Can anyone think of a way of helping him?
I suppose we could do as we did before and try to open up some kind of passageway into this text and see if she can be retrieved from there. I suggest we prepare ourselves as best we can. For a start, it does seem that Mr. Hammett has written a rather rough book here, so I would suggest that those who have such implements as guns do get them ready just in case they're needed. Obviously looking at Hamp and Rita. So perhaps if you get your weapons ready, then perhaps, Milton, if you and I prepare a suitable space for this little expedition.
What do you propose?
I would suggest that we take the pages of this manuscript and paper the walls with it.
Interesting.
I'm sure Miss Rita won't mind us using her office for this.
No, not at all. Come over here. I got it all set up. You know, this is the Nora corner, I call it, really. Isn't that right, Nora? It got all the stuff. There's a pot of glue I got for you. You can put the pages up.
Ah, yes.
Really easy. And I mean, I would love to help. You know, I've been reading all of Hammett's books and I've been really thinking back about all of the little things that Nora did and had and all those kinds of things, you know, trying to tune in with her on the astral plane. So, you know, I'm sure I could help out. I've been training.
In all your researches, have you found any connections between the astral plane and the pages of the pulp magazines?
I normally find that I fall asleep after about between 3 and 5 pages. I've got to do it in chunks.
Ah, so in that respect, Mr. Hammett is your gateway to the astral realm.
You could say that, absolutely.
At this stage, I will take anything I can.
Fantastic. I love that. I love it.
This sounds crazy enough to work.
Okay, so you do your incantation.
Yes, paper the walls of Rita's office with the book. And yes, I suppose we don't have any of that blue substance left over, but that may be for the best. Let's just
probably
see. Yes, let's just see how this works on its own.
So you start the spell, and you need to make a hard power roll, but you will get a bonus dice.
Okay.
Ooh, and you did it. Goodness me.
Oh, blimey, yes.
Yes, yes. So the words, those strange backwards and inside-out words come out of your throat. They're almost coming deep inside your lungs, somehow being spewed out.
Well, I think, yeah, Emery is quite hesitant at first, you know, because his experiences of this spell, as interesting as they've been, haven't entirely been happy ones. But as the words come out, it's almost like they start pouring out of their own volition.
Yes, and we're not going to try it again. We're not going to try and say it ever again, but
no.
The room starts to get dark. The four of you, at first you think that maybe the sun has set, or... But it was a smoggy day and there wasn't any sun, and it's still morning or afternoon or, you know, lunchtime. And yeah, everything's going a bit dark. And then you see that the walls are starting to get thin, like thinner, like they're almost transparent now. And you can see through into this stretching out landscape of undulating. Well, I suppose it's like paper, and the words written on the paper start to move around and shift. And at first you're back in San Francisco, in a detective's office, and then something odd happens. The scene changes, and suddenly you're in darkness, and everything's wet. You're getting wet. You're getting rained on, and then there's a lightning strike up above, and a huge rumble of thunder, and then suddenly you're all blinded. The four of you are blinded by bright, bright light being shined in your eyes. And through a megaphone, a voice comes.
Drop your weapons or we're going to shoot.
And that's where we will end it.